Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. Shir Ali Tareen's fascinating new book, Perilous Intimacies, Debating Hindu-Muslim Friendship After Empire, explores how leading South Asian Muslim thinkers imagined and contested the boundaries of Hindu-Muslim friendship from the mid-18th to the mid-20th centuries. In this episode, join Tareen and our panel for a thought-provoking exploration of a complex and sensitive topic. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this timely conversation considers what the future prospects might be for these two religions that share such a profound and intricate history.
Good afternoon. Assalamu alaikum. Namaskaram, everyone. Thank you for being here. My name is Saeed Khan. Glad to be here all the way from Detroit and from Wayne State University, where I teach Near East and Asian Studies and Global Studies there. Always good to be back into Bradford and welcome all of you to the festival. Today's session is going to be centered around this book, Perilous Intimacies, Debating Hindu-Muslim Friendship After Empire, by our esteemed author, Shir Ali Tareen. And let me give you a little bit of information about Shir Ali's background. Shir Ali right now is the Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, which is very close to, for those of you unfamiliar, near Philadelphia. And his area of focus is on Muslim intellectual traditions and debates in early modern and modern South Asia. Some of his books include Defending Muhammad in Modernity, a 2020 publication, one that actually won the 2020 Book Prize by the American Institute for Pakistani Studies, and of course, his most recent book, Perilous Intimacies. But joining him in this conversation, we are very honored to have also Professor Iftikhar Malik, who is a professor emeritus of history at Bath Spa University, a historian himself of South Asia, of political Islam, and of Muslim diaspora communities. Some of his representative publications include Pashtun Identity and Geopolitics in Southwest Asia, 2016, and Islam and Modernity, Muslims in Western Europe and the United States, 2003 publication, and Full Disclosure, a book that I use in my graduate seminar on Islam and the Challenge of Modernity. Professor Malik is just very self-effacing when he says, well, it's a little bit old of a book. I said, but the themes and the issues that he raises are still quite timely and ones that have quite a bit of currency among my students and in the debate. So welcome to both of you here. When I think about Hindu-Muslim friendships, I always think about where I think everyone should start, and that's Bollywood. And I think about growing up and movies like Amar Akbar Anthony, where you have, and I'm going to give away the plot a bit, so I'm sorry, where you have three brothers who separated at birth or early childhood. Amar, who's Hindu, Akbar, who's raised Muslim, and Anthony, who's raised Christian. And similar themes you found interwoven into movies, particularly in the 1970s and the 1980s, movies like Naseeb. And I'm sure now most of you have most of the soundtracks swimming through your heads of movies like that, including the song Jaan Jani Jana Jan. And how these framed ways that we then saw a rather ecumenical India, particularly when it came to two of the largest communities there, the Hindu majority community and one of the largest Muslim minority communities in the world, that being in India. Today, if we were to explore the pages of the news, either social media or otherwise, that era of ecumenism seems to be a bygone era. And the notion then that not only can Hindus and Muslims be friends, but were they ever friends? And I think that Shir Ali's book explores this topic in the requisite depth and the scope and the scale and the respect by which a topic like this ought to be addressed. So Shir Ali, the floor is yours to talk about, of course, this and delving into your book as well.
Thank you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you so much, Saeed. I want to begin by thanking the Bradford Literature Festival, Saima, Lizzie Newman, all the other people who have made this possible. And I really feel fortunate to be here, not only as part of the Bradford Literature Festival, but to be in this phenomenal city of Bradford. It's really been a fascinating and incredible experience. I also want to thank Dr. Iftikhar for sharing this stage with me. It's a true honor. And I also want to thank all of you for the gift of your time. I'm really honored and privileged to be here. So I thought maybe in around 20 minutes or so, what I would do is speak a bit about the larger concerns and argument of this book, and then perhaps we can get into more of the details in the conversation that will follow. So first, a sentence about what is this book about. Very briefly, this book is about intra-Muslim scholarly debates, discourses, and contestations on the boundaries of interreligious, more generally, and Hindu-Muslim, more particularly, friendship from the mid-18th to the mid-20th century. And before I get to any kind of things having to do with South Asia or Islam and so on, just taking a step back in terms of what is the larger philosophical, conceptual theme, problem that is examined in this book. Perilous Intimacies conceptually is a book about the productive tension between two ideas or two concepts. One, the idea of friendship, and the other, the idea of sovereignty. The relationship and the tension between friendship and sovereignty. And friendship as a relationship is a quality that always binds the self with the contingencies of the other. By its nature, friendship is something that binds you to the other and its contingencies. So there is a certain kind of dependence which is interwoven into the very concept of friendship. But sovereignty is then an ideal that assumes independent mastery and ownership of the self. So in what ways does this underlying friction between friendship and sovereignty emerge as a site of intra-Muslim scholarly debate and contestation on Hindu-Muslim friendship during a historical moment in South Asia, mid-18th to the mid-20th century, which is marked by the loss and eventual absence of Muslim political sovereignty? So basically the question here is that when a community loses its political sovereignty, in what ways does it then imagine and contest its sovereign power? And how does interreligious friendship become a primary theater, a primary site for those contestations, for those articulations of sovereignty and sovereign power? So now let me come to the title of the book. What is happening with Perilous Intimacies, Debating Hindu-Muslim Friendship After Empire? Let's begin with the first part of it, Perilous Intimacies. I'm really interested in this book to think about interreligious friendship and especially Hindu-Muslim friendship as a quality that involves both a promise but also a peril. And here, one sort of exercise that I was interested in conducting in this book was to put into conversation Western philosophical reflections on the idea of friendship, and then how friendship as a category is talked about in Muslim intellectual thought. So very briefly, in Western philosophy, right from Aristotle onwards to someone as recent as Jacques Derrida, there is this idea of friendship representing what one contemporary philosopher called Alexander Nahimas has called the double face of friendship, meaning friendship is a relationship that promises the highest forms of virtue, but it can also be extremely damaging or even self-eviscerating for someone blindingly bound to a harmful friend. So friendship is both a promise that affords you certain possibilities, benefits, capacities, but it can also be a dire peril if you get blindingly bound to a harmful friend. So putting this kind of reflection of the promise and peril of friendship into conversation with Islamic intellectual thought, where the category that I'm working with most dominantly is this Arabic term called muwalat, M-U-W-A-L-A-T, which comes from the Arabic roots waliya, which interestingly also has this kind of a dual etymology, but here friendship and sovereignty are not so much in tension with each other, but very closely related to each other. How so? The roots waliya, from which we get terms like wali, or friend or friend of God, Sufi masters, from which we get the term wilaya, which can mean sainthood or a certain kind of dominion. Interestingly, this concept as well has this dual etymology in that the wali is both the friend of God, is a friend, but then the wali can also be a guardian. The wali can also be someone who has sovereign authority. In fact, God describes himself in Surah Al-Baqarah as the guardian of the faithful. So the idea there is that if you engage in the correct forms of friendship, which intensify your virtue, then you would also be intensifying your political dominion, your power, your mastery over the other. So I am really interested in this book to think about how, during a moment in South Asian history marked by the dwindling and eventual evisceration of Muslim political sovereignty, how does this kind of a tension between friendship and sovereignty, but also the kind of intimacy between friendship and sovereignty, gets played out in intra-Muslim debates that involve some of the most powerful, some of the most influential and well-regarded Muslim scholars of South Asia. So now I would come to the second part of the title, Debating Hindu-Muslim Friendship After Empire. What do I mean by after empire? A central conceptual question that animates my interest is this. How does a religious community engage and draw on a normative tradition of law and ethics when the very political context that informed that tradition is no longer available? In other words, though the pre-modern Muslim intellectual, and more specifically the Muslim legal tradition, the Sharia, is very diverse and multivalent on the question of Muslim, non-Muslim relations and friendship, there is no one singular uniform opinion, nonetheless, that legal tradition and discourses in it on this question of interreligious friendship is nonetheless informed by a political context of Muslim imperial sovereignty, of Muslim empire, especially during the formative period of the Islamic legal tradition from the 8th to the 10th centuries of the Common Era, whereby establishing the supremacy of Islam and Muslim identity over non-Muslims represented a foundational purpose of law. So in the aftermath of Muslim political sovereignty, in a setting like mid-18th to the mid-20th century India, how did Muslim legal discourses and debates on the question of interreligious or more specifically Hindu-Muslim friendship showcase the encounter between two things? There are these two kinds of encounter that I'm most interested in the chapters of this book. One, the encounter between the legacy of the pre-modern Muslim legal tradition that was grounded in a political context of Muslim imperial sovereignty. And then the second thing, the new conditions, the new categories, the new expectations of what came to be known as colonial modernity that had as its backdrop the loss of Muslim political sovereignty. So that encounter between the legacy of the Islamic legal tradition and the new categories, the new expectations, and the new terrain of colonial modernity, how do we see that encounter reflected in intra-Muslim debates on Hindu-Muslim friendship? My main argument and the main point of this book is, one of the main arguments, I should say, is that in these Muslim legal debates on the boundaries of interreligious friendship in Islam, you see competing notions of Hindu-Muslim friendship, of the boundaries of Hindu-Muslim friendship. These competing notions corresponded with competing conceptions of Muslim sovereign power in the aftermath of Muslim political sovereignty. And even more specifically, I argue that with the loss of Muslim political sovereignty, for some of the most prominent among the Indian Muslim scholars and jurists of this time, from the mid-18th to the mid-20th century, sovereign power, or this capacity to decide, the capacity for decision, and I'm not thinking about sovereignty just in the sort of conventional sense of the sovereignty of the modern state. In fact, one of the main purposes of this book is to have us think about sovereignty beyond the modern state, to think about the capacity to decide for a community beyond just the state and its processes of electoral democracy and so on. So one of the main arguments I make is that at this moment, sovereign power came to increasingly reside in establishing and preserving what are called markers of Muslim distinction in the public sphere. And these markers of Muslim distinction were invested in practices of everyday ritual life, like cow sacrifice and so on. So the everyday becomes a key theater for the exercise of Muslim sovereign power, in the absence and with the impossibility of the resurrection of a Muslim state. So somewhat paradoxically, the loss of political sovereignty made possible an expanded sphere and notion of politics and sovereign power that was not territorial or bound to the state, but was situated in the domain of everyday ritual practice and premised on the desire to maintain and preserve embodied difference and distinction over non-Muslim others. So now, in 5 minutes, I just want to give you one example, very quick example of, this is the larger point of the book, among some other points that I'll, for the interest of time, not mention now. But let me give you a very quick example of then how does this play out in an intra-Muslim debate. An example I want to give for illustrative purposes that I think is most suitable for a 5-minute recap is an example that comes from exactly 100 years ago. This year marked the 100 years of the fall of the Muslim Caliphate, the fall of the Ottoman Caliphate, and the formation of the Turkish Republic. So 100 years ago, there was a really profound and fascinating intra-Muslim scholarly debate that took place in the context of what was known as the Caliphate movement or the Khilafat movement, whereby some very prominent Muslim scholars who were both the seminary-educated Muslim scholars and also Muslim modernists who went to Western institutions of learning, who came together and collaborated with Gandhi and the Indian National Congress to put pressure on the British colonial government to salvage the territorial status of the Ottoman Caliphate. And one of the ways in which they try to do that is by arguing for Hindu-Muslim friendship, Hindu-Muslim mawalat or friendship and collaboration politically. And to do that, some of the scholars associated with this Khilafat movement, such as a very famous scholar called Abul Kalam Azad, died in 1958, another scholar called Maulvi Abdul Bari, died 1925 or so. Their main argument was that in the context of colonial India, where Muslims are thinking about the relationship between the British, the Muslims, and the Hindus represented non-Muslims of the variety for whom entering into friendship is sanctioned by the Quran. So they, for example, gave evidence from the Quran where there is a verse which says, chapter 60, verse number 8, that Muslims are permitted to enter into friendship with those non-Muslims who don't fight Muslims on the basis of religion, don't throw them out of their homes, or don't aid others in throwing out of their homes. And their argument was that in the context of India, Hindus are those kinds of non-Muslims who are non-belligerent and do not attack Muslims. Whereas the British were the non-Muslims described in the next verse, which says that those non-Muslims who do these things, attack you, throw you out of your homes, abet others in throwing you out of your homes, those are the kinds of non-Muslims you cannot enter into a friendship with. And they argued that the British were those kinds of non-Muslims because of the colonizing designs against the Ottoman Empire. And another key argument that they used was that if the British continue to intervene in a matter of religious sensitivity for Muslims, the Ottoman Caliphate, that would contravene their own promise of secularism, because then they are entering into the domain of the religious. And there are many other aspects of their argument which I will leave out in the interest of time. But on the other side, there were equally important and influential Muslim scholars. For example, the founder of this major Muslim movement in colonial South Asia called the Barelvi School, their founder, someone called Maulana Ahmad Reza Khan, died in 1921. His counter-argument was that no, he again went to those two verses in the Quran and said, how could you argue that Hindus are the non-Muslims who don't attack you in matters of faith? Go to any village town and try sacrificing a cow and see what will happen to you. And his main argument was that when it comes to the British, we need to make a very interesting distinction that he made between substantive friendship of the heart, and then mere transactional relations. And so his argument was that you can continue mere transaction relations like taking funding from the British for Muslim schools and colleges. That's where this debate really erupted, because the Khilafat movement leaders had said that Muslim schools and colleges should abandon all kinds of aid, all kinds of funding that they get from the British, because they were arguing for this idea of complete severance of ties with the British state, what they call tark-e-mawalat, complete severance of ties. So this guy, Ahmad Reza Khan, counter-argued that no, you can engage in mere transactional relations, but not substantive friendship. Hindus are among the non-Muslims who do attack you on account of your faith. And the third main argument, the most crucial one for my argument, which I talked about a few moments ago, for Ahmad Reza Khan, in the absence of Muslim political sovereignty, with the resurrection of a Muslim state no longer a possibility, Muslim sovereign power, the Muslim capacity of decision, was invested in markers of Muslim distinction in everyday ritual practices, like cow sacrifice. So that's where his energies were invested. Because this was, the cow sacrifice was a massive a debate at that time, because the Khilafat movement leaders had argued that in order to establish a collaboration and friendship with Hindus, Muslims should abandon cow sacrifice out of their own will. And Ahmad Reza Khan counter-argued that no, you cannot undermine or erase a marker of Muslim distinction like cow sacrifice under the pressure, under the coercion of Hindus and Gandhi. Now, the last point I would make on this intra-Muslim debate, and then close things up, is that interestingly, the Khilafat movement leaders had a counter-argument to this point as well, that cow sacrifice is a marker of Muslim distinction, and hence we should not erase it. And their counter-argument was that fine, we agree that cow sacrifice is indeed a marker of Muslim distinction. In fact, Maulvi Abdul Bari, this scholar I just mentioned a few moments ago, even said that you should not be coerced into abandoning this kind of a distinctive marker of Muslim ritual life. But he also said that what could be a more important marker of Muslim distinction and power than the caliphate? So for him, by entering into a friendship with Hindus and the Indian National Congress, you would salvage the ultimate marker of Muslim distinction and power, the caliphate. So he famously said, what is the cow when put next to the caliphate? And Abdul Bari made a very interesting logic. He said that abandoning cow sacrifice is an exception to the norm. Normatively, yes, Muslims have to engage in cow sacrifice, but it's an exception to the norm in a moment of political and theological tribulation or difficulty for the Muslim community, where the Ottoman state needs help from Indian Muslims. So in this kind of moment of emergency, you engage in an exception to the norm in pulling back from cow sacrifice. Now, finally, in 1 minute, what is the significance of this, of all of this in contemporary South Asia? And in fact, in contemporary diaspora communities around the world, especially the UK. I'll give just only one example. I mean, Saeed mentioned this, you know, Bollywood and the promise of Hindu-Muslim friendship and so on. One thing that I really want to do in this book is that I really want to listen carefully to logics of life, to logics of religious identity that don't map very easily and very seamlessly onto contemporary liberal secular understandings of a good Muslim who ought to be at peace with the other, who ought to not take his or her identity too seriously in terms of boundaries and so on. I really want to take seriously the sophistication of the arguments of scholars like Ahmad Reza Khan and other scholars whom I talk about in the 6 chapters of this book, who may not sit very nicely with our contemporary sort of notions of pluralism and interreligious harmony and so on, but there are very sophisticated logics at work there. And even if you want to critique them, it is important to learn their logics of argument. So in contemporary South Asia, for example, there is a young Muslim scholar, activist, called Sharjeel Imam in his mid-30s, who's been imprisoned since 2020 in exceedingly difficult conditions in the Tehar jail in Delhi under charges of treason. And his main treasonous instigation was that in 2020 January, he gave some speeches in India where he basically called for protests against the racist laws, the NRC, the CEA, which had been passed by the Indian government of that time. And in one of his speeches, towards the end of his speech, and I focus my epilogue on that speech, he makes a very provocative argument where he goes back exactly to this cow sacrifice debate from a century ago. And he makes a provocative argument that the Khilafat movement leaders may have had good intentions of allying with Gandhi and establishing Hindu-Muslim friendship and so on. But he made the argument that it was these Khilafat movement scholars who opened the door, who paved the way for the contemporary Hindu nationalist cow vigilante violence against Muslims, Dalits and so on. Because they paved the way for Indian Muslims to capitulate and erase their ritual practice, a marker of Muslim distinction. But the next thing that Sharjeel said is very interesting. He said that why is it that in our contemporary curricula in India, in other places, when we think about India and its history and so on, why do we not consider with the same depth, with the same charity, with the same sympathy, the perspectives of a scholar like Ahmad Reza Khan, who does not sit very nicely with contemporary notions of interreligious harmony and so on? And why is it so focused on people like Gandhi, Abul Kalam Azad, and others who may make us feel better about our own identity? Now, one does not have to agree with all aspects of Sharjeel Imam's categorization of the Khilafat movement leaders and how he's talking about them. But I think he's up to something very interesting where he said that our history has not been written. It will take 50 years for us to write our own history. He's talking about Indian Muslims. And what he meant by that was a history of South Asian Islam, a history of Indian and South Asian Muslim identity, which is not, you know, limited to the territorial boundaries of the contemporary nation state of India, writing a history that is not interested in finding from the past good and bad Muslims who could then be, you know, assigned particular kinds of blame for what went wrong, or, you know, so this a vision of studying Indian Muslim history, South Asian Muslim history in a fashion that goes beyond the labor, the hunt for good and bad Muslims, and to not look at these intra-Muslim debates according to binaries like good Muslim, bad Muslim, inclusivist, exclusivist, liberal, conservative, but to really get into the logics of their internal debates. And from those logics, what we realize is that these debates are too sophisticated to be theorized under these kinds of binaries, which can be very distorting. I'll pause there. I apologize if I went a bit over 20 minutes there. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This notion that you mentioned about binaries is so critical because, I mean, obviously then there's the intra-Muslim complexity of binaries, and then, of course, also inter-religious notions of binaries and how each sees the other. Dr. Iftikhar, I'd like to go ahead and move to you and your reflections on what Dr. Shahid Ali has said.
Well, first of all, my thanks to the organizer of Bradford Literature Festival and, you know, for inviting me. Not a stranger to Bradford. I've been an external examiner for a number of years for the university. And this is an excellent book, and I would invite you to read it, to buy it. As a historian, I see it's grounded in lots of archival research, and it's very topical, although it talks about the late 18th century all the way to early 20th century, but some of the issues that we talk about today in reference to India or to Pakistan or to diaspora, I think you would get the very good grounding. It's a good, excellent contribution in intellectual history. I have to be more forceful because the author happens to be a student of my former student. And you always say good things about your former student. Qasim Zaman, who teaches at Princeton University, I taught him about 40 years ago, and then he went to McGill, and from McGill he went to Brown, and now he's teaching at Princeton. And he's one of the great scholars of Islam in South Asia, and he's the chap who wrote the book, books like Ulama, The Custodians of Change in South Asia, and more recently, a very comprehensive book of Islam in Pakistan. I do feel, in a larger context, as a historian, how do we place Muslims in the most plural and the most popular region of the world, where they make the largest number, the largest proportion of Muslim community in the world, South Asia? I think the problems that you were trying to tackle in your book, in your research, predate this era, predate the modern period. Though with the arrival, with the advent of the Raj, this debate became more intense, and it goes on. I mean, during the time of Akbar the Great, Mughals, there were efforts to bring these communities together. And even before that, you have mentioned a great Sufi, Amir Khusrow, who was very proud of his Muslim identity and his Hindu mother, and very proud of being an Indian. I'm not saying that Hindus and Muslims were always poles apart, but the other view, which was sort of propounded before the partition and after the partition, especially in India, under Nehruvian influence, you know, Islam and Hinduism have always met together, and they have created syncretic traditions. So that view also overlooked the tensions, underlying tensions, which went back into the centuries. This also raises the issues about Muslims. Who are these Muslims in the South Asia? Generally, I mean, people would say, well, these Islam came from outside, so maybe Muslims came from outside. My feeling is that Muslim rulers might have come from outside. Many of them were, let's say, Turkish, Afghans, with Persian elite, but most of the Muslims were local converts. And though the term Turk, was always used by Muslims, that they are from Central Asia or related with the larger Turkish world. And this is also a term which is again revived by the BJP in India, sadly. But I think the problem started in the modern period because the way South Asian or Indian history was categorized or defined. Ancient history, medieval history, and modern history. And ancient history was kind of considered to be classical history, where classical Hindu past was seen as the ideal period. And I'm not dismissing it. You know, period of Chandragupta, Maurya Empire, Gupta Empire, Ashoka, all those things. And then the medieval period, the way Europeans for a long time looked down upon the medieval period, calling it the Dark Ages, same kind of paradigm was used about the medieval period. And people generally would talk about the Crusades, or they would talk about the Mongols. So everything happened in the past. And then comes the modern period with the European empires, and everything is being restored or being created. So this is where medieval period became very problematic. So Muslim period was considered to be the medieval period. So the way, you know, periodization has taken place of the world history, and not just of South Asia, has created lots of tensions for us. And maybe we have appropriated or misappropriated or misunderstood this categorization in India and Pakistan, and even in diaspora, in a very negative way. There's more emphasis on separation and less emphasis on commonalities. The other categorization, which is even more dangerous, which is even more inimical to understanding South Asian history, is Hindu period, Muslim period, and the modern period, which means British period and the modern period. So I think this periodization we need to revisit, and many historians are doing that. And I'm glad that you have picked up this area, and you start with Al-Biruni, for example. Al-Biruni was a fascinating person. I don't know how many of you are aware of it. His book, Indica, is considered to be a classical study of Hinduism. He was originally from Bukhara. I visited his place. And he came down with Mahmud of Ghazna in the 10th century, and he spent 7 years in the Salt Range. And he worked with the Hindu Brahmins. He learned Sanskrit. He revived the study of Sanskrit, and he wrote this classical book, Al-Hind, Indica, which still remains a classic. And Al-Biruni looks at the class factor within the Hindu society. And then we, you know, see more and more people writing about it. You talk about Mazhar Jana, you know, in Urdu. He's sort of trying to understand Hindu religion and looking at the commonalities. But my feeling is that when you talk about political sovereignty, it worries me. Why? Because V.S. Naipaul, you remember his book, Among the Believers, and later on a couple of other books, though I know that he became a supporter of BJP, he says Islam is an imperial religion. Islam is a conquering religion. And this is where I am worried that the civilizational aspect of Islam, as a part of global tradition, global civilization, is sort of ignored. So I would like to look at the study of Muslim experience in South Asia beyond politics. So that's one issue that I would like you to sort of come back to, I mean, during our discussion. The second issue that I have, and it's worth looking, and it's not your criticism, is that most of Indian history that we write about is focused on northern India. And this is a totally different model of Hindu-Muslim relationship. Whether we look at the UP or we look at Punjab, the biggest migration happened, sadly, in 1947. And that's also, you know, this has been used by different people to interpret Hindu-Muslim relationship in different ways. But we know that most of this violence happened in Punjab, which is divided between India and Pakistan. What happened in Bengal? I mean, dislocations happen in Bengal. Dislocations happen in Lower Indus Valley, Sindh, but not that much violence happened there. So my worry is that when we write of the history of the subcontinent, we are mostly focused on the UP, on Punjab, Northern, and we think that maybe similar kind of relationship between Hindus and Muslims existed elsewhere. With Kerala, Tamil regions, southern regions, which we call Deccan, perhaps they had a different kind of equation between Muslims and Hindus. Despite the fact they also had Arabian influences, they had Persian influences and Bahmani states and other states, also African influences, which we generally ignore, sadly, when we write the history of the subcontinent, because we ignore, mostly underplay, Indian Ocean slave trade. We focus more on Atlantic slave trade. So my feeling is that we need to look at the diversity in that experience. I do feel that you raise very important issue about Maulana Azad, because Azad is being revisited by Muslim historians. Because Azad, being an alim, being a religious scholar, perhaps in many ways he was ahead of his time. For example, what he wrote about the Ottoman Empire. And he says, I mean, you mentioned Khilafat movement. He said Khilafat, people forget, Muslims especially forget, that Ottoman Empire stopped or delayed the expansion of European colonialism for centuries, which Muslims have to realize. Whether it was Persia or Mughal India or Central Asia, the Ottomans, you know, withstood all those onslaughts. So I think that's the point you make. And that is why I think Maulana Azad was prepared to make some compromises with Hindus. And his idea of Indian nationhood incorporated both Hindus and Muslims. He was not very happy with the idea of partition. Because like W.C. Smith, who taught in India and later on established this eminent center for Islamic studies at McGill, where Qasim Zaman studied, he wrote a book soon after partition. And he thought that Muslims in overall, and especially in South Asia, were in a very difficult situation all along. Globally, Muslims had a difficult time when the Prophet passed away. And people thought this project called Islam will wither away. Then the second time when the Mongols invaded, Mongols from the east, crusaders from the west, and Islam would disappear. Islam survived. And then he said, now the European colonialism of entire Muslim world, this is the most serious challenge. And then something else W.C. Smith said, which many people maybe in Pakistan would not like to listen to. And he said, maybe the partition of India was not partition of India. It was the partition of Muslims. So Azad's views were very close to what W.C. Smith was saying in the 1950s. But study of Indian Islam very quickly, I think we need to go back to people like Sayyid Ahmad Khan. You talk about Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan, but you don't mention too much of Jamaluddin Afghani. These are the two giant Muslim personalities of the 19th century. Sayyid Ahmad Khan is saying we need to modernize. He is a kind of Martin Luther of Islam in India. And he said we shouldn't worry about Muslims outside the subcontinent. And he was also trying to redefine the relationship between Hindus and Muslims. But he thought in the meantime, Muslims should not participate in the politics. They should put their house in order. And he got, you know, I mean, this university in Aligarh, he got people like Theodore Morrison to teach in Aligarh. Theodore Morrison is a Jewish scholar, first Jewish graduate from Oxford, who was invited by Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan to teach at Aligarh. He is the man who said, Indian Muslim, in the late 19th century, this Jewish guy in Aligarh is saying, Indian Muslims were like Jews of Europe, scattered and with no common united platform. I mean, we have a book on our fellow historian who has written a preamble to your book, Faisal Devji, which is called Pakistan, a Muslim Zion, a Muslim homeland. But, you know, the idea actually started in the 1890s with Theodore Morrison and people like Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan. What is the future of the largest Muslim community, but again, the largest Muslim minority in the subcontinent? So my feeling is that Sayyid Ahmad Khan is important, but Afghani criticized Sayyid Ahmad Khan. Jamaluddin Afghani thought Muslims should not compromise to regionalism. They should look at themselves and they should make an effort as a global community. So Muslims of Ottoman Empire, Muslims of Egypt, Muslims of India, Muslims of Iran, Afghanistan should come together. And that is what we call pan-Islamism. But Sayyid Ahmad Khan, on the other hand, thought, no, we should put our own house in order through education, through westernization, and even Muslims should not participate in politics. So these were two kind of pathways which were being discussed in the 19th century. And I think then in 20th century, of course, you talk about Ahmad Raza Khan, who was the founder of Brelvi School. Most of the Muslims in this country follow Brelvi School, which is a kind of Sufi Islam. And though most of the seminaries in this country are Deobandis, and you talk about Deobandis and all that. So my feeling is that this intra-Muslim debate also is linked, not just with the Raj and what the Muslims are facing, I mean the elite. I think it was also linked with what kind of literature was being produced, especially in places like Punjab. Arya Samaj is very important, worth looking at, because we focus more on Mahasabha, 1920. But before Mahasabha, which was the forerunner of BJP, today's BJP, we have Arya Samaj. Now, Arya Samaj appropriated Aryan origins of Hindus. And this is where, because some British scholars and German scholars like Max Muller, and before that, Sir William Jones, they thought Indians were Aryans. And you know, this whole all thesis. So Hinduism became Aryanism. And some French scholars use this Aryan or, you know, definition of Hindus because of anti-Semitism. Montesquieu, Voltaire, they said that even long before the Jews, Hindu Brahmins were the intellectual leaders of the world. So this Aryanness eventually results into what we call Arya Samaj. But Arya Samaj, revival of Hinduism as Aryas of the past, retrieving their past and martial races, a martial tradition, did not succeed in Bombay, did not succeed in Madras. Dayananda Saraswati, who was the founder of Arya Samaj, he did not succeed in those regions, but he succeeded in Punjab and in the UP. And that is why the reaction, partly, you know, Deoband, and later on, Tablighi Jamaat. Tablighi Jamaat evolves in the 1920s because of Arya Samaj. Some of these Muslims on the margins are converting to Hinduism. So I think there are lots of these forces among these communities. I mean, for example, very quickly, Bengal I should mention because I'm focusing more on Northern India. Bengal Renaissance is a great event in the late 19th century. Intellectual, I mean, we know about Rabindranath Tagore and people. They were talking about Bengal and greater Bengal traditions, and Islam was absent from these scholarly works. And one of them, Neeraj Chaudhary, he thought Muslims are just poor peasants that he confronted or encountered in Eastern Bengal. He was offered a job by the BBC in Delhi in 1920s. He undertook a journey, train journey, from Bengal, Calcutta, to Delhi. And he was amazed that Muslims had created these monuments. They had history, they had culture, they were part of a very dynamic India. And it was a discovery for him, discovery of India by one of the leading scholars of Bengal, Neeraj Chaudhary. I'm sure you've come across his name, Autobiography of an Unknown Indian. He lived up to 102. I used to see him in Oxford. Oxford never gave him a degree, but he was an apologist. Very openly, apologist for the British Empire. He discovered Islam while traveling from easternmost regions of the subcontinent to the UP. So I think this, and that's why I think Pakistan eventually becomes popular, because most of the followers of Jinnah were poor peasants, and they were promised lands, because the lands were owned in Bengal by Bhadralok, and these were not Bhadralok. So there are lots of these economic tensions, there are regional variations, which I think are very important, but subcontinent is a big subject. So I don't, you know, expect one historian in one book to deal with all these issues. But it's a fascinating book, it's a great contribution in intellectual history. When I was reading his book, I remembered Aziz Ahmed, who is the founder of intellectual history in South Indian Islam, and because we focus more on political history now, a little bit on economic history, a little bit on regional history, but intellectual history in reference to South Asia has been compromised. So I'm sure with Tareen's book, there'll be more interest in those areas of, because I remember the great scholar of Middle East, Albert Hourani, who was the founder of Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Oxford. I used to sit with him in the 80s and early 90s at St. Anthony's College. On Wednesday, we used to sit in the buttery, and he would say 18th century was the century of Indian Islam, and we need to do more research on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before we open it up for questions, Sherilee, I'd like to give you the opportunity in a couple of minutes. I know it's a short period of time. If you would like to just go ahead and respond to Dr. Iftikhar.
Yeah, I'll take 2 minutes. You can time me. Thank you so much, Dr. Iftikhar, for these very panoramic comments. I guess the one or two things that I would say in response is to think about the category of Muslim imperial sovereignty, or what I call an imperial Muslim political theology. I think you're correct in pointing out that a pernicious misreading of this concept could be that I'm referring to some kind of a timeless Muslim imperial sovereignty or a timeless Muslim imperial political theology that these then modern scholars are stuck in. And it can be seen to sort of provide fodder to a certain kind of Islamophobic conceptualizations of some kind of a, you know, a Muslim imperial sovereignty, which is always timeless and it is natural to the tradition. And that, of course, would be a gross misreading of what I'm doing with this category. My interest in the specific field of Islamic legal discourses and debates on Hindu-Muslim friendship has to do with the question of when the contextual background of a set of discourses and debates is no longer there, how do modern actors then begin to conceptualize, articulate, and debate the idea of sovereign decision, sovereign power, Muslim political capacity in a completely altered set of conditions? And by imperial sovereignty, I'm not referring to the sovereignty of any particular entity, the Sultan or the scholars, the ulama and so on, but this larger conception of the relationship between decision and identity and how that takes on new forms in the modern period. The other thing I would say very briefly is that my main argument is that, as I said, in these debates on inter-religious friendship, you have competing conceptions of Muslim sovereign power. So for example, in this example that I gave about the Khilafat movement, what we clearly see at work here is that for one group of Muslim scholars, in the absence of Muslim political sovereignty, it is the institution and the symbolic capital of the caliphate which stands in for Muslim political sovereignty and decision, this kind of global umatic sort of institution of the caliphate. Whereas for some other group of Muslim scholars, no. First of all, the Ottomans were not even rightful claimants to the caliphate because they lacked the lineage of the Prophet's tribe, the Quraysh. And secondly, in the absence of a Muslim state, it is the choreography of everyday life that is the most premium site of the exercise of Muslim sovereign power. So, you know, someone like Ahmad Reza Khan gets particularly angry when one day the Khilafat movement leaders invite Gandhi to give a speech at the pulpit of a Friday congregational prayers. And for him, that was the ultimate insult on a distinctive marker of Muslim sovereign power. So what we have here is, and coming back to your question about the relationship between colonial conditions and Muslim intellectual thought, what we have here is we have both continuities and discontinuities. So in some ways, these scholars are engaging with a tradition which has a much longer life before colonial modernity. And they are engaging within their tradition, their own concepts, categories, and so on. How should we read the Quran? How should we think about Islamic law and so on? But what is new here is that they have to contend with a set of conditions and categories and a terrain that is not of their making or choosing. So for Abul Kalam Azad to say that you cannot intervene in a matter of religious sensitivity by attacking the Ottoman Caliphate because that undermines what? Your own doctrine of secularism. And that even someone like Ahmad Reza Khan says that don't forbid us from sacrificing cows because that again undermines the promise of religious freedom, because this is a marker of Muslim ritual distinction. So these very categories they're using now, secularism, religious freedom, and so on, is coming from a terrain that is not of their choosing or making. So I'm interested in this encounter between this ongoing Muslim intellectual tradition, which has its own protocols, texts, and forms of argumentation, and then these new categories, these new ways of arguing that belong clearly to a new modern colonial sphere and terrain. I'll stop there.
All right, thank you. I'd like to open it up to questions that you have in our limited time. We do have a roving mic, so if you'd like to go ahead and ask a question of our... Yes, we've got a question here, and then we've got a question there. Oh, we'll take the lady first.
And then thank you. Thank you. Okay. Is that working? Yeah. Yep. Thank you so much. Wonderful discussion. And I haven't read the book yet, but I'm looking forward to doing so. To pin down further this question of this concept of sovereignty and keeping in mind the kind of distinctions you've sort of sparred about slightly, this is a question for you, Shirley. Is it different from self-determination? Is it different from agency, which is an amorphous concept, but agency in the sense of a political idea of being able to be a self-determined community within the larger Hindu-dominated leadership? So could you just slightly clarify that point for me? Thank you.
Okay. I think what we'll do is we'll take four questions at once, because I think that will probably max us out. So the gentleman here, the lady in the front row, and then the gentleman here.
I was going to ask you about the position of Aurangzeb.
Aurangzeb.
Aurangzeb, yeah.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Lady in the front.
I was actually struck by what Dr. Iftikhar said about, I think you quoted W.C. Smith, that partition was not a division of India, but a division of Muslims. An argument that is used in Pakistan these days, which I question, is that partition and independence of Pakistan was justified because of what's the way that Muslims are being treated in India now. But I feel that they would not have been treated like that had they not been divided. They would have been a much stronger part of India. So this argument for me doesn't hold weight. So I just wanted your comments on that.
All right, thank you. Last question here, please. And then, I mean, if you don't mind, maybe perhaps after. Yeah.
Just very quickly, Sherry, you talk about sovereignty again. And You talk about, one of the ways people talk about sovereignty is the sovereign is the one who decides on the exception. At the same time, there's always been this argument among Muslim circles that a sovereign is God, and therefore the ability to decide on God cannot have an exception. And I'm wondering whether, when you talk about sovereignty, how you negotiate those two understandings and what they actually mean for the idea of a Muslim sovereignty.
Okay, thank you. Gentlemen, we have 5 minutes, and I know that we do have to clear the hall for the next session with that, so we are under some constraints. So I'd like for you to go ahead.
Yeah, so I'll just bunch the questions on sovereignty together. Yeah, I am interested in the sovereignty as a promise, which is in some ways an asymptotic promise, which is never fully achievable. It's not a thing which is materialized. It's an aspiration. It's a promise. And it's a promise that strives for distinction and domination over the other. And there are multiple different categories in Urdu, Persian, Arabic, the three languages that the book is focused on, ranging from Khilafah to Satwa to Hayba to Iqtidar and so on. But I'm thinking about this not in terms of any one particular category in any of these languages, but how these different categories come together in indexing a notion of distinction and domination, which is not centered on the exercise of a centralized state, but rather is invested precisely in the choreography of everyday life, in maintaining embodied distinction. Although for people like those in the Khilafat movement, of course, sovereign power was invested in the institution of the caliphate. So it's not that all Muslim scholars in this time period or before this or after it had this notion of sovereign power in embodied life and everyday ritual practices. But I do think that from the late 18th century onwards, the intensified focus on everyday ritual life as a site of authenticity, as a site of the articulation of the promise of Muslim domination and distinction is something which can be captured by this category of sovereign power. So I'm thinking about this as an aspirational promise which is never fully realizable. And that is what in some ways distinguishes it from theological notions of sovereignty as well, although it's connected. The question on Aurangzeb, I think, is quite illustrative because the whole point is to step back and not entertain the temptation of reading either contemporary actors or these historical actors from contemporary desires such as dividing them up into rosters of the inclusivists and the exclusivists, the good Muslims and the bad Muslims. So someone like Akbar, for example, in his paradigmatic concept, which is oftentimes cited as the example of how he was this great champion of Hindu-Muslim friendship, Sulh-e-Kul, peace for all, and so on. Sulh-e-Kul in Akbar, and in the articulation and theorization of Abul Fazl, he is drawing that from a much longer tradition of Islamic ethics, where Sulh-e-Kul is not about some kind of equality of all traditions, but it's about repairing, reform, the idea of sulh, from which we get the word islah or reform, which nonetheless still maintains the supremacy of the Muslim subject. Aurangzeb, on the other hand, sure, he commissioned the coming together of this compendium of legal opinions called Fatawa Alamgiriya, but on other occasions, he also commissioned land grants for the construction of Hindu temples and so on. And all these Muslim scholars whom we talk about, Al-Biruni was mentioned, he's seen as this great scholar who produces encyclopedic masterpiece on Indian civilizations. The first sentence of his book, The Book of India, and I'm paraphrasing here, the exact citation is in my book. His first sentence is that these people are different in every possible terms than us. That's the kind of distinction with which he begins. And then he proceeds forward. 18th century scholar Mirza Mazhar Jane Janan, who had this very thundering endorsement of Hindu intellectual traditions and said there are a lot of correspondences between Islam and Hinduism, he nonetheless maintained that that is only true until the arrival of Islam. And all Hindus after the arrival of Islam are nonetheless still infidels, and he does maintain the supremacy of Islam. So I think one has to be confident about articulating a Muslim imperial logic and sovereignty without that being seen as some kind of capitulation into Islamophobic narratives about the bad Muslims who are always stuck in the promise of trying to retrieve power. But to listen carefully to these logics of life that don't sit that nicely with contemporary Western liberal understandings of the good Muslim and the bad Muslim, the liberals and the exclusivists. But to take these scholars who might make us feel a bit uncomfortable in terms of what we might desire as good Muslims, to take them seriously on their own terms. And to final my point about the question that you raised about the bad treatment of Muslims in India not being seen as something triumphant for Pakistanis. Well, I mean, you're correct in the sense that there is nothing triumphant for Pakistanis to talk about in this climate, politically, you know, even the cricket match they lost against the US, so there is nothing triumphalist happening in Pakistan anymore. But I do think that one must not undermine the perniciousness of majoritarianism and the underlying Islamophobia that is written into the very constitution of modern nation states like India. In that when we make this kind of a division between the current India of the BJP and then a previous India, which was liberal, secular, the Nehruvian India, that kind of division of the good India, the former good India and the current bad India, is in itself implicitly Islamophobic, because it erases the suffering and the racism against Kashmiris. It erases the racism and suffering against a number of Muslim actors, including people like Sharjeel Imam, who was in fact even more critical of the Congress than he was of the BJP, who imprisoned him. So I think it's very, very important to not get into that kind of a liberal, secular, discursive mode where we're either looking for good or bad Muslims or good or bad Hindus, but rather to look at the modern nation state as, in its very constitution, a pernicious force that always prioritizes majoritarian sensibilities and logics. And even if the minority in India might have been a Muslim minority in India might have been a more sizable minority, maybe the violence would have been less blatant, but I see no reason why the Indian nation state would have been any less Islamophobic than it is currently. So I think it's very important not to make this kind of a binary between the good India and the bad India, because that is inherently Islamophobic and deeply offensive, especially to Kashmiris.
Well, thank you. On the issue of sovereignty, I'll just quickly say...
I'm sorry, Dr. Iftikhar, we will. I'm getting the stage directors saying that we do have to conclude because we'd have another session.
Right.
Perhaps we can go ahead and continue the discussion offline, particularly with Sherali having his book available for sale and for a book signing afterwards. Thank you, Sherali.
Thank you,
Iftikhar Malik. Thank you for joining us. And enjoy the rest of your stay at the Bradford Literature Festival. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.